Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, Sports City. Welcome to the Sunday Morning Brunch. Y'all are here at the Cornerstone Show. We got a lot of stuff to jump into. We seen some historic stuff pop off yesterday. Has not happened since 1978. We have a chef here around that time, too. But I took off this blazer, loosened up the tie, stepped aside, the kitchen timeless is alive.
Oh, welcome to Sports City. CP Timeless is at the helm.
Feeling kind of Sunday.
Moses taking care of the Midwest. I'm TP Timeless holding down the East Coast.
TP, I am ready to back rock.
And the only thing, I got one thing to wish you people.
Good morning. It's a Sports City chef with Sunday the Brunch with Mark and TP.
Good morning.
So kick back, relax, enjoy everybody, don't turn on the TV.
Good morning.
It's a Sunday morning brunch with Mark and Moses and TP Timeless.
Good morning.
So sit back, relax, and 2 hours of facts. That's a fact, yeah.
Ooh, the caller number is 917-889-9592. You got the next 90 minutes locked and loaded with Sports City. Y'all could have been anywhere else in the world, but you're here with the chef. So I got to get this show started as best as I possibly can. I hope you guys are ready. Website, sportscitychefs.com. Got a lot of interesting stuff popping up. And just for you people to know, right, it may be June. But football will be back in the kitchen in 2 or 3 weeks. So y'all stay tuned to that, too. Football ain't gone. Y'all might have seen the front office take some time off, but football ain't gone. Now let me get into this show as I best possibly can. Calling in by way of California, the host of the NFL front office show here at Sports City, my co-host, Brian Breaking News Hughes. Welcome to the brunch. How are you feeling this morning?
Ty, I'm feeling great. It's beautiful over here on the best coast. I'm ready to get after it.
Wait, the best coast is the East Coast. Wait, you're on the West Coast. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that that's happening to you. I'm sorry that that's happening to you. I mean, you're already, what is it? It's 8:02 in the morning over there. You're over there stretching and yawning. We up here moving around, got our mojo back. I'm sorry. See, this is what happens for us. Even when we start shows off, we're going to get into a heated debate regardless. Let me get this show popping. Like I said, 1978 is the number, people. That's the number. I just want people to know that's the number right now. Also calling from the West Coast, I guess he might feel some type of way, too. We have Mr. Silver, a.k.a. Nacho, my co-host from the Food Fight Saturday. You already know what we about to get into. This is an electric show, Sports. We got a lot of stuff behind us right now. But Mr. Silver, welcome to the brunch. How are we feeling this morning?
No, I'm feeling good. Birds chirping, beautiful morning. We still got the rest of our day. It's not halfway done over here. So, best coast.
It ain't halfway done. It's only 11. They said it's halfway done. Wow.
You only get 24 hours in the day. You almost to 12.
Hey, I'm sorry. Listen. Okay, we about to get into it. Now, I know we have not seen this. The closest person here is Brian Hughes, and I know he wasn't seeing this at the tender age of months of birth, if you will. But the horse American Pharoah wins the Triple Crown situation, and this is something that has not been done in 37 years. Complete the situation. A lot of people are up in awe about the situation around this horse. I know we do not talk about horse racing at all, but I thought it definitely deserves some gratitude and some ground here in the kitchen. I want to see how you guys feel about the American Pharoah completing something that was basically very elusive in horse racing, from the Belmont Stakes, Kentucky Derby, so on and so forth. Brian, I'll start with you first. Just to give the horse his due, I mean, this is an American history situation behind the American Pharoah. Your thoughts?
To Montreal.
Did we lose Brian? Brian, are you there?
Sorry. I had a pause there. Or I had it muted. I think the big thing to take away from this is, like you just said, how incredibly difficult it is to win the Triple Crown. If you're not a horse racing, you know, aficionado, if you're not somebody who enjoys the sport, you're not going to understand the significance of this. It has been almost 40 years since somebody has won the Triple Crown, which is the three major legs of horse racing for that year for three-year-old horses. And, you know, when you consider the fact that people, the way the horse racing is set up, whether it's fair and not fair, whatever you want to call it, the fact that they'll allow horses to race in individual legs of the race, but not race that do not have to race in every single leg, that's a major contributor to why we haven't seen a winner in the last 37 years, Ty. You go back to last year, and you look at California Chrome. That horse was by far the best, fastest horse, but by the time, after the Kentucky Derby, by the time he had gotten to the third leg of the race, which is this last race, which is actually a longer race, he just didn't have enough left in the tank. And I know for most people that's probably thinking, well, that sounds ridiculous. It's been, you know, 3-4 weeks since the last time they raced, but it does make a difference in horse racing. So to not only see American Pharoah win, but the fashion in which he did it, the last corner to actually be pulling away like that, is super impressive. Bob Baffert, the trainer for the horse, this is he is kind of like the Bill Belichick of horse racing. If you were looking for a comparison, or you know, a Greg Popovich, he has elevated himself to that elite status. Excellent trainer. He's coached and trained. Now it's eight Kentucky Derby winners. His horses are always really good, really fast. But like I said, Ty, the most impressive thing of that whole entire, you know, of all of yesterday, if you watched it, was that on the last leg, on the last turn, American Pharoah was actually pulling away. The race was closer until they got to that last stretch. And, I mean, the horse won in super impressive fashion. You know, the last race, you know, Firing Line was right there with him. It went down to the wire. He ended up, American Pharoah ended up winning by a, you know, a nose, a neck, whatever you want to call it. But it was very impressive this last race, and American Pharoah made absolutely no doubt who the winner was.
And I'm not going to sit here and lie. I'm not big into horse racing, but knowing how significant the situation was, just like you said, this feat hasn't been accomplished for nearly 40 years. It is pretty big, and to have it done in the stage of New York out here in the Belmont Stakes is pretty impressive, knowing that he already took care of business in the Preakness as well as the Kentucky Derby. I think all of the pressure was there. But just like you said, Baffert being the owner, and to literally be honest, his horses are always competitive, and I don't know how to do the horse betting situation. I don't really like to condone the betting situation here at Sports City, but if I knew how to do it, I would. I had a lot of people that try to invite me down to the derbies or the Preakness as well, or the Belmont Stakes, and I'm like, I just don't know how to judge a horse. But I feel like the percentages to go with Baffert and see how you pan out, whichever horses he's bringing to the track to try and roll with them and deal with the punches later. Nacho, your thoughts on the American Pharoah, winning the Triple Crown and taking home the title in the Belmont Stakes here in New York.
I'm here. I was reading something. As it goes for American Pharoah, I'm not like you guys said. Most people don't watch horse racing as much as maybe Dan does. But I don't really watch horse racing that much. I only watch it when I hear the words Triple Crown and possibility, with last year's with the Chrome and all that stuff like that. I was watching that towards the end, but I don't really watch it unless the Triple Crown is involved because, like you said, it's been so long since it's happened, and it is an historic event to watch happen. So I was excited to watch this race, and like Dan said, towards the end there when he was pulling away, it was a thing to watch. You know, just how close the last race was. And to watch him just pull away and make it definite that he is the best, and you know he's well deserving. He being the horse, he's well deserving of winning this Triple Crown. I think it was 5.5 lengths, if I'm not mistaken, 5.5, 6 lengths, winning the race. That's just awesome. So, and I every time we do watch these Triple Crown possibilities over the last few years, the horse that's supposed to win the Triple Crown, that's the possibility of winning it, always seems to, lose for majority of the race when I've been watching. It hasn't been that close. Some of the other horses, it seems to me, their jockeys seem to try to, as soon as they get behind them, obviously it's a race, but I don't know. It just seems a little, I don't know how to explain it, but it doesn't look like it's very fair in what they do. I don't know if that's the horse racing or whatever. Like I said, I don't watch that much, but sometimes it looks like there's a little bit of cheating involved. I don't know how you could constitute cheating in horse racing, but when it comes to these Triple Crowns, obviously no one wants to see a winner, so they want to hold them back. But I think the way American Pharoah did it by leading from the get-go and just dominating it and dominating it to the very end was very fitting. So I was excited to watch it, but I'll be excited to watch it next year if there's another horse that's ready to win the Triple Crown. But like I said, I only watch it if that Triple Crown is involved.
Okay, so I know this. If I do get involved in the horse racing, I am checking out the situation behind Baffert. I'm rolling with him because he's a usual face that you see every time they get to the track. He always has a horse out there that's in the race and possibly out there to make something happen, so on and so forth. So, I feel like I can roll with Baffert. If I lose, I lose. That's the risk you're taking, horse racing. I got to pick it up somehow. I've been pushed to try and do it, and I got to give these horses their consideration. And like I said, I'm not big into the sport, but I definitely had to give it some credit because this is historic. And I didn't want to overlook the situation. And I don't have too much on it, but from what I had, I had to try and address it early in the show. So I definitely wanted to give it its ground. Now, another interesting situation in sports also, things have gotten tied up in the Stanley Cup Final where the Tampa Bay Lightning actually get to take a game at home up against the Chicago Blackhawks, winning the game 4-3. Now, interesting enough, the Blackhawks have won game one, so they actually take the home ice advantage away. And also interesting in this game, Chicago had taken an early lead in this game, going up 2-1, and knowing that you guys know people like Mark Mosley, that is a portion of the family here, he wasn't the one bragging, but people that he knows and people out there in Chicago that I know were already like, we can actually take this, we just got to hang on, we're up 2-1 early. And then Tampa Bay fights their way back and ties the game, went up a goal, and actually extended the stretch. And then they went up a goal, went up 3-2, and then Chicago tied it up, and then they actually ended up taking over the lead midway through the third period to have an even series going to Chicago. Now, I still think this actually favors Chicago going back to Chicago right now because they actually went to Tampa Bay and did what they needed to do, at least take one on the road, so it puts more pressure on Tampa Bay to play better hockey. Especially in the state of Illinois. I want to know how you guys may possibly feel on this series, whether you feel like the Lightning still have a legitimate shot to actually put pressure on Chicago to win one in the United Center, or Chicago being here several times in the past 3-4 years, winning championships twice, they're basically tasting blood in the water, and this could actually be a doom situation around the Tampa Bay Lightning. Ryan, I'll come back to you first. Your thoughts on this series, whether you feel strongly for Tampa Bay at least getting a game, and with their goalie, Ben Bishop, as strong as he's played all postseason, they removed him from the game twice in the third period. So there is a bit of question around Bishop, at least to the Tampa Bay Lightning or the coaching staff. But your thoughts on this game, too, where they evened everything out?
Yeah, Ty, I think you hit the nail on the head what I was going to actually discuss, which is the fact that, you know, the Lightning pulled their goalie, Ben Bishop, and they put in the rookie, and I can't pronounce his name, so I apologize. But I will tell you, I did get to see some of that game, Ty, and the kid looks really good, really good. So, you know, at least if nothing else, there's confidence there. But I think in certain sports, I think the Lightning may go back to Ben Bishop. But I will tell you, in certain sports, you know, like baseball, when you're talking about starting pitching, when you know, hockey with the goalie, certain sports, I think it's important to go with a hot hand. And if it was me, I would probably start the kid. Give Bishop a night to kind of just, you know, decompress, if you will. Like you said, he's played outstanding in the playoffs, not creating any controversy, but if he comes in and saves the day, no biggie. But Chicago is a tough, tough environment to win in. If the moment's too big for the kid, you'll know right away. But I was really impressed. But, yeah, I mean, it was so important for them to win a game, Ty. Well, going into the series, that was basically what I stressed on is, you know, look, Chicago has a ton of experience. I mean, you look at some of their players. Some of their players have already won 2 Stanley Cups. I don't know if the entire Lightning team has that much experience. You know, I know they have at least one guy with a Stanley Cup win, but my point being is Chicago is a team that's been here. They've done this. They've been down. They've been up. They understand the grind. And the Lightning are a young, really interesting team, but they're still learning their way right now. Picking up that game the other night was absolutely crucial because you cannot go down 0-2 at home in a situation where you have home field advantage or home ice advantage, if you will, especially to Chicago. There's no way in hell that they are going to go into Chicago, them being the Lightning, and win 2 games. So for them to pick up that game, it really meant the difference in this series, in my opinion, being over and not being over. If they can figure out a way to get one of these next 2 games, we got a real legitimate series. And, you know, once again, the Lightning just never cease to amaze me. They, you know, they continue to fight, continue to scrap. And, you know, when you think they're out of it or when you think, you know, experience should dictate something else, they continue to claw and scratch their way back into it. You know, they're fighters, man. They're a very scrappy team. And, Mark, I love you, but, you know, I can't watch the play of the Tampa Bay Lightning and not pull for them. You know, we've seen this story with Chicago. We've seen them do this, you know, every other year that the Kings don't win. It seems like it's the Blackhawks. But, you know, I got to tell you, I've been really super impressed with Tampa Bay. And you know what? I'd love nothing more than to see them win one for the Florida area.
Wow. Already beating up on Chicago. Look, this Western Conference stuff is real. In California, I tell you, they really nip and claw at people if they're doing their thing. And not to say, like, he doesn't want to see Chicago win it, because I understand if Chicago wins for a third time in the past, 5 years, it's very interesting for these guys to try and bring another cup back to Chicago. But, Tampa Bay is the best offensive team in hockey as of now, so I think they can pose a threat on the road, but I think Chicago has all the momentum trying to get back there, knowing that they actually won a game with Tampa Bay and actually pushed them to the brink and having a lead late in the game where Tampa Bay actually fought their way back to get the lead and win the game in the third period. Nacho, your thoughts on this series? Do you think Tampa could get to Chicago and at least get a game back, or do you think Chicago is actually safe? And for leaving in Crawford. But to me, Crawford could be one of the more questionable goalies. If he shows up, he's sharp. But a lot of teams have actually attacked him and actually been able to score. So this actually can actually help Tampa on the road if he gets too comfortable in between the pipes. But your thoughts on this Game 2 situation and also overall for both teams, whether it's Chicago or Tampa, moving into Game 3 and Game 4 going to Illinois?
You know, Game 2 was a pretty good game. Now, you guys know I'm not the biggest hockey fan, but the Stanley Cup Finals, you can't miss. It's a championship, and you got to watch it. So I've been keeping up with both these teams pretty much through their conference finals and the way they persevered through tough tests on the road and at home. It really feels that Tampa Bay and Chicago, to me, these guys are going to go back and forth. They're going to go seven. As it pertains to this second game, as well as the first game, I saw the Chicago Blackhawks score pretty quickly, two goals back-to-back almost. I believe in the first game it was, what, a minute and 30-some seconds apart. In this game, it wasn't more than 5 minutes apart. They scored pretty quick back-to-back goals. And if they continue to do that throughout the series, being able to get a goal and then feed off of that and get another goal quickly. Now, we're not talking a minute 35, but if they get one quickly and as it pertains to the sport of hockey, getting one almost right after it, it might be hard for Tampa Bay to be able to come back. I know they play fast, and last night they were able to keep up and get four goals before Chicago could get two, and then Chicago ended up getting the third one late there. But I really feel that this is going to go seven the way both teams are playing. I am with Dan, though. I just can't not get behind the Tampa Bay Lightning the way they came out, the way they've been playing. I like it. I like that style of hockey, and it's fast. And I love it. I love fast hockey that goes up and down the ice quickly, hard-hitting, and it's really fun to watch. So I'm definitely behind Tampa. I think it goes seven, and I think Tampa can close it out at home.
Look at the West Coast in the building. They are really pulling for Tampa Bay right now, and it's even. So
hey, Ty.
Yes, sir.
I just want to quickly agree with Nacho. I also agree with Dan.
I'm trying to figure out who Dan is, but hey
Dan
I'm,
is the
I'm,
guy
I'm,
that always says the right thing, man.
I'm sorry, man.
That's
Brian.
Right. That's my code name. That's why I agree with Dan.
I'm still searching for him, man. He might be pulling for the Raiders again this year. Who knows?
Who knows?
Hey, you just wait till you hear the name I put on next time.
Okay, no problem. I know how to address you regardless. But still, if it's a 1-1 series, we're getting back to Chicago, and anything could happen. I know this, the Blackhawks can't let their guard down because Tampa does have some fast young skaters and could score easily. Especially going up against Crawford, where Crawford's always been the initial guy that they focused on trying to help Chicago win games and not win a Stanley Cup. And to be honest, Chicago wasn't supposed to be here. Chicago was a team a lot of people thought Anaheim would have took care of business and cooling that thing out. And they're here. And knowing that Tampa had to survive this storm up against the Rangers, they have an interesting success story. But knowing Chicago has experience, I don't know. I really feel Chicago with the experience and having, two different Stanley Cup wins actually spells a little interesting situation for Tampa to let one of those games go. So I don't know. I'm not going to start pushing for sides on if I'm rolling with Tampa. I'm still bitter with Tampa. I'm not going to lie. I'm still bitter. But Chicago, you know, and knowing how crazy that area gets when the Blackhawks are doing good, I was out there, like I said, a few years ago with Mark, and knowing Chicago got wild when they won that championship a while ago. So it'd be interesting to see him get back to Chicago, but it'd also be interesting to see if Tampa can get it done because, you know, a lot of – when they're in the championship perspective, they don't expect youth to overcome, veteranship or guys that have been here. So this is a true test for both teams. If Chicago can actually keep their momentum and stamina going back home and not letting their guard down, and also Tampa – trying to force that offense to put a lot of pressure on Crawford at the end of the day and not get caught up in interesting penalties and giving Chicago a power play and situations for them to win games. So They have to. Tampa has to play better because they're letting Chicago score at an interesting clip. Chicago actually can believe that more that they can score on Bishop, but Bishop has actually been a strong goalie throughout the postseason and through the regular season also. So this is something to watch. I did want to give it its ground before we got away from it. The caller number is 917-889-9592. Another big main event situation that went down in the kitchen and also on the, you know, the premium package, if you will, Channel Network. We had Daniel Gill going up against Miguel Cotto in a championship fight. And we had this conversation yesterday on the Sports City Food Fight. And we had an interesting guest come in there and said it won't be a walk in the park. And I didn't think it was going to be a walk in the park, but because he's a professional fighter, you know, and I really thought that it wasn't a big bout, if you will, for Miguel Cotto. Because I'm going to be honest, the start to that fight, very slow. A lot of people that were watching it that I was with said that, you know, these guys are more or less trying to, you know, test each other out, but it was no real drama to it. And then once they started really going at each other, I really felt like Cotto had his legs underneath him and landed the shots that actually were working Gill, and he dropped them twice. And I don't like seeing this in boxing, but once you see a guy give up, it actually hurts me because you're out there trying to fight and don't want to get hit like that. At least you want to, like, endure, I mean, throw some pain back to this guy. And he basically told the ref no more. He gave him the old Roberto Duran, if you will, being Daniel Gill. So I do want to see how you guys feel about this. Nacho, I'll let you start this one off first because I know this is your dish. Your thoughts on the fight, getting stopped early in the fourth, where we were actually told that this won't be a walk in the park. This would actually go late. It did not go late. And all of the post-fight discussions as well here in the kitchen today.
You know, the first off, the fight was exciting from around, like you said, from around 2-3 to the end of it at the beginning of the fourth. The thing is, that left hook for Miguel Cotto was working all night, and it was working masterfully from the body to the head, to the head, to the body. You can hear Freddie Roach say that all night in the corner. You know, that's what I want you to do, be more active. And he did. The thing is, Daniel Gill did this before when he got punched out by Triple G. He got up. The ref asked him, and he said no. There's a certain thing about Daniel Gill. He's a pretty smart man. He knows that if he's outmatched in the ring and he's going to continue to get hit pretty hard in the head, he's not going to ruin his future and his family missing him later in life just because he wants to prove a point. He knew Miguel Cotto was the better man last night, the better boxer, and was planting that left hook on him all night. Ended up trying to do try to duck a hit from Daniel Gill, ended up headbutting, subsequently got up when Miguel Cotto raised up, hit him with a left hook to the head, lights out pretty much. Daniel Gill was able to get up, and then he got knocked down again, and it was just over. So the fight went as according to plan, as me and you thought. I really thought it would be, a fourth, fifth, sixth round knockout. Daniel Gill did what he did pretty much with Triple G, got knocked down a couple times and gave up. He knew he wasn't the better fighter or boxer, so he gave up. Miguel Cotto is the lineal champion for a reason. The post-fight interview lets me further know that we won't see Miguel Cotto for 1 year, and he will fight whoever he wants. By coming out when they asked him, the post-fight interview went as this. Max Kellerman, who I think is a pretty great interviewer, he did an excellent job against Pacquiao, or interviewing Pacquiao. I don't want to say against, interviewing Pacquiao. And when he interviewed him, he started off asking him how he felt, how the year off felt. Miguel Cotto said it was fine, and then he went to the big questions. You know, when are you fighting next and who are you fighting next? Miguel Cotto's instant answer was, I'm taking time off to be with my family. Last fight he said that, we didn't see him for a year. So Miguel Cotto wants to sit on this championship for a year. He doesn't want to fight anyone. He wants to let these big dogs, Triple G and Canelo, either knock each other out or lose to someone else so they're out of contention. So when they asked him about Canelo, because they asked him individually, they asked him about Canelo, he said, that's a fight that the fans want. That's a fight that the people want. We will get that together and we will do that fight if that's what they want. But first I want to go ahead and, you know, take some time for my family and rest. And then we'll see what happens after that. That's exactly what Miguel Cotto said to the Canelo. And then when Triple G was asked, when Max Kellerman asked him about Triple G, Miguel Cotto froze up like a little girl and did not answer the question the way I would have liked him to answer it if he was the true lineal middleweight champion. No, he does not want to fight Triple G. He knows Triple G is a class above him and a weight class above him, as well as just a better boxer and a stronger one at that. So he wants none of Triple G. He said, you know, maybe if it's there along the lines after Canelo and the fans still want it or whatever BS he made up after hesitating for about 5 minutes and then said, but first I want to take time to hang out with my family and rest and, you know, collect my thoughts. So we won't see Miguel Cotto for another year, and it's very upsetting because now Triple G is going to have to knock out 5 or 6 more guys over the next year and a half before Miguel Cotto actually either gets stripped of that title for not fighting his mandatory or has no other choice but to run into Triple G. So it's upsetting me, but I got to live with it. That's the way the sport does it. But like I said, it was a great fight for Miguel Cotto. Knocked out Daniel Gill quite easily, a guy who had a pretty good chin. Even though he got knocked out by Triple G, he had a pretty good chin going in, and he was a pretty good fighter. But, you know, pretty good fighters don't beat great boxers. So Miguel Cotto won pretty well last night, and that's all it is to it. So I just wish he would fight the guy he's supposed to fight.
Now, before I throw it to Brian, right, now here's the interesting situation. Knowing that Cotto is going to – he's 35 as of this year, right? As of this year in October, he'll be 35. Do you think Ring Rust will play a question in whoever he fights next? Now, knowing he's going up against a young bull, if he is to fight Canelo, Canelo is young in his you know, early 20s and has an impressive record, even though a lot of people still question his resume on who he's fought other than Floyd Mayweather. Do you think that this Ring Rust could play a situation? Because he's patient when he fights, so he more or less wants to counter and catch dudes out there. But knowing that if he does end up fighting a guy like Canelo, Canelo has also been in a fight with Floyd Mayweather where he has to learn to be patient as well. So this could actually spell doom for one of these guys because they actually swing with intention. So that's one. And two, if he is going to sit up here and fight Triple G, which the world wants, I think a lot of people want to see Cotto versus Triple G, especially a lot of people that I've actually talked to. They're not – a lot of people that I talk to now are not impressed with Triple G right now. A lot of people actually tell me, look at his resume, Ty, and you tell me who interesting has he fought. And I really think about it, all of the guys that he's fought really are no title holders or big names in the sport. It is guys that he had to face and take care of business. So he had to do what he had to do at the end of the day. So a lot of people are actually discrediting Triple G, especially to go up against a guy like Miguel Cotto, where they actually think Miguel Cotto could actually win that fight if they do fight at a catch weight. To make Triple G lose weight to fight Miguel Cotto. But your thoughts on those situations before I throw it to Brian?
You know, the first situation with Miguel Cotto and Canelo, that fight going down and the ring rust that you talk about Canelo having, if it is within a year, I don't see Cotto standing a chance against Canelo. You get Canelo to fight pretty much one more time or even two more times between now and then. If it's not Triple G, he's most likely going to win, and he's going to get sharper with time and age because he's so young. And if Miguel Cotto does wait that long, I don't give him the total advantage like I did against Gil or anyone else that he's fought. See, the thing is with Canelo, he's just going to get better and better from here on out. And like I said, without fighting Triple G, who's going to be his biggest test? And someone that would, you know, that would be an amazing fight to watch, but someone's got to lose that fight
and it's, you know, whoever loses is knocked down a notch. I don't care who it is. So, you know, it's going to be a great fight when it happens, but Canelo's just going to get sharper with age and with the fights that come up for him. So him and Miguel Cotto in a year is going to be, you know, not in Miguel Cotto's favor. So Miguel Cotto needs to fight him within the next 6 months to 7 months and get back in that ring and prove why he's the champion. Now, the second part of that question was Triple G and getting questioned. Well, this is the part of the sport where I dislike and I hate the most because no one is made to fight anyone anymore. You pick who you want to fight, and if they don't want to fight you, you don't have to fight them. They put people in front of Triple G, and at some point they were the best that has tested Triple G because of the resume he had, and he keeps knocking these people out. After a certain time, you know you're fighting such C and D level fighters that you don't have to prepare as much because you're a top notch level. You're a lineal champion without a belt because this guy doesn't want to fight you. So Triple G has to sit there and just award or take whatever comes at him. He can't go pick the people he wants to fight and make him fight them because they're never going to fight him, every single one of them. So that's why he's got to fight these second-rate fighters, knock them out early, pump up that record, and keep waiting and waiting and waiting for a championship. This is why sorry I'm going on a rant right here, but this is why boxing needs a unification of the organizations to have one championship, to make people fight for one championship. That way there's not 7 to 8 different championships, and people can just do what they want, however they want, whenever they want. And if you don't want to fight someone, because everyone in this division knows Triple G is the lineal champion, but he can't fight the guy because he's never going to fight him. So it's just beyond me that the guy's the mandatory, but now the WBC is saying the winner of whatever, Daniel Gill and Cotto, will fight Canelo, and if that winner has to promise to fight Triple G, see, that's the BS. If he's the mandatory, he should be fighting right now for the lineal championship in the next couple months. But Miguel Cotto wanted to take an easy fight, and he wanted to make some money so he could take some more time off and sit on that championship. That's the way boxing is when it pertains to championships and things like that. So that's why I'm so excited about PBC and what they're doing. Premier Boxing Championship is going to unify boxing and make boxers have to fight each other and make divisions and weight classes mean something. And you're going to have to fight the best in that class to win a championship in PBC. And if you don't get to be in PBC. So that's why I'm so excited for the free boxing and PBC and what's going on in that more than I am with the WBO and the WBC and the W whatever and the I's and the B's and the O's and whatever and the F's, all that stuff. You can just get it out of here because they just do whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want. It's all about money. It's not about proving yourself as a true champion.
Okay, Brian, your thoughts on the situation and what happened last night with Miguel Cotto winning the fight up against Daniel Gill and the perspectives in front of him in the future. And like Nacho just alluded to, that he wants to take a year off. Now, a lot of people actually get mad at the fact that, you know, like, let's say, for instance, Floyd Mayweather takes 2 fights a year. They want to see him fight more. But these guys are getting up in age. They're in their 30s. And you got to respect these boxers because they're actually taking punishment while being in there. But in this fight where he actually fought Gil, he didn't really get beaten bad. No cuts, no big-time bruises like we normally see in a Cotto fight, because Cotto usually bleeds or gets cut somewhere in his nose or his eye area. He actually was fine. But knowing that he has big perspectives in front of him, whether it be the situation with Triple G or Canelo, where they're trying to pin him to, with him having the championship, your thoughts on this main event situation, which clearly got taken care of earlier in the fight?
Well, let me start off by saying I completely agree with Machiavelli that Cotto should not take a year off. What I heard, and I'm sure you guys have heard the same things, but from what I've heard through a couple different sources, is that Oscar De La Hoya is working with the promoters from Cotto, and they're trying to get this fight set up at the end of the year. Obviously, they want to get it too close to the next Mayweather fight, which is supposed to take place mid to late September. But, I mean, I can't even talk about the fight. I mean, you guys know how I feel about quitters. I mean, I just don't get it. Like, I don't even understand how these guys get to that stage in the career. And I understand what you're saying about, you know, hey, he's a smart dude because, you know, he's getting wrapped in the head and he's, you know, there's no sense in taking that for 12 rounds. Well, I mean, that's kind of the profession that he chose to get into. So you're telling me if you're not going to be able to win the fight, you're like, oh, this guy's definitely better than me. All right, never mind, I quit. I don't want to do that. But if it's competitive, then you'll stick in it. I just don't like it. I wish that the fighters could not quit, that the only person who could quit is the corner. Because the corner is less likely to quit early than the actual fighter. Remember 15, 20 years ago when that was not the case? There'd be, you know, you'd have a fighter with an eye hanging out, stumbling around, and his corner would throw the towel, and he'd be like, what are you talking about? I'm fine. I can still go. Like, you know, when did it become acceptable or okay for fighters to just decide that they no longer wanted to keep fighting? You know, I get he was clearly outclassed, but I'm sorry, and this is just me. Maybe I'm an old-school boxing fan. To me, it's never acceptable to quit. It's just not. You're in a sport that emphasizes being a gladiator, a winner, and not quitting, and you quit because things get tough. I don't know. I think Geely's a bum. I think Cotto benefited from the fact that he fought a bum. That's just the way it is. I don't care who he fights next. And I've watched Cotto for a really long time. That's how long he's been in the sport. I don't care if it's Canelo, Triple G, insert name here. I think he probably loses his next fight. I mean, I when you look at, you know, he lost back-to-back fights, went to Freddie Roach, but really, who has he fought that you're like, wow, that was really impressive since he's went to Freddie? Everybody's talking about, oh, since he's been with Freddie Roach, you know, he's a new fighter. He's a different fighter. He's, you know, he's this, he's that. Well, I haven't seen him fight anybody that I was like, wow, that was a big upset, that, you know, that win right there. So I'm not that impressed. I just wanted to rant for a couple minutes. I agree with Machiavelli, but I just wanted to say that I just hate quitters, Ty. You know that? It's the one thing I always complain about in boxing and MMA. I get it. You know, in MMA, it's kind of part of the sport. It's like a built-in part of the sport. Hey, I can tap out if you're about to squeeze my head off. But I just hate the fact that people can quit. I think, you know, if you want to let the cornerman do it, if you want to let the ref do it, that's fine. But fighters should never quit. You know what? If you're in MMA, pass out like every other fighter does. If you're a boxer, just get knocked out and quit complaining.
Well, I understand the MMA because it's several different instances, and I don't want to see people go to sleep because it could be a problem trying to get these guys back up. You know what I'm saying? Or if they don't tap out, these dudes are in an armbar, they can end up breaking their arm or breaking their leg. Like, so I understand if they feel that type of pressure, they got to do it in MMA. They have to do what they have to do to survive to fight another day. That's different. So I understand where you're coming from. However, in boxing, especially in a situation where, yeah, he got knocked down twice. The first one, he got caught right on the butt and almost knocked completely out of the ring. And when that punch landed, he was knocked out to the point where his eyes were closed until he hit the canvas and had to get himself back up, restore his energy to try and, you know, fight Cotto some more. After Cotto knocked him down the second time. Now, here's the interesting situation about the second knockdown where, I'm not going to lie, I respect the heck out of the sport of boxing. I love boxing to death, but Daniel Gill, I laughed at you, and everybody that was around me actually felt the same way because we were watching the same exact doggone fight. Cotto landed that hook, and Gill didn't know whether to stay up and box or fall down to the canvas because it was a clear punch. It was a clear punch that landed to the head. But he still had, you know, his feet under him. He could have either stood up and shook off the rattle or whatever, he didn't know whether to stand up or fall. He fell, got up, the ref was like, you were all right? And he said, no, no more. And they waved him off and ended the fight. Like, it was like, wait, hold on. Are you here collecting a check? That's how I felt. That's literally how I felt. Cause like, Gil, and I can't wait till Saturday comes back around because we had an interesting guest that came on and actually supported him. So I can't wait to talk about this situation about Gil. I don't think Gil will get another big-time fight. I'm sorry.
The thing is, Gil came to Cotto. Gil went to Cotto and his people. So that gave Cotto the opportunity to say, dang, I don't have to fight all these other people. I can fight this bum right here real quick and make some money, and he can make some money, and I can prove I'm a champion and take another year off. So, yeah, you know, Cotto's one of those people that takes the easy route. Now he's a champion. He beat a bum, Martinez, on a bum knee to win this championship. Now he gets to ride it out, be the A side every time he boxes, make some money, and ride it out until he retires. So I'll be happy when he does.
Well, we'll see who's next in his hourglass, if you will, or crystal ball, however you paint the picture. But like I said, Gil can't sit up here and just collect checks at the end of the day. He has to come in here with some, blood in the water attitude or have a little nastiness about him. And it really looked like he was trying to spar more or less with Cotto instead of trying to fight him. Of course, he threw some interesting punches and landed here and there, but once Cotto knocked him down the first time, I think really he felt the same effect that he felt in front of Triple G, where he didn't know how long this was going to last. And once that second knockdown came down, and he literally didn't know whether to stand up or fall down, because if people really rewatch what happened in that fight, how he got knocked down a second time, it literally disgusted me. It literally disgusted me. So I don't know if he gets set up for another big-time title fight. It's up to all of the promoters that will actually end up trying to push him. But I doubt it. I doubt it. His name gets removed unless he's getting ready to spar up against somebody else in his weight class or wants to have him on an undercard. But he won't get another shot like that. Triple G and Cotto did their jobs in exposing him, knocking him out or knocking him down, and him not surviving to get at least past the seventh or eighth round. So
it's a fifth quality round. Fight.
Him in the Barclays, you know, like it's a big venue now out here in Brooklyn. That arena is a pretty interesting arena. I've been there several times. I love it in the Barclays, to be honest. But Gil, I think you're going to have to go back home and start laying dudes down in Australia before the American crowd starts to feature you again as one of these title shot guys. And plus, he's 34 right now, so I don't know how much he could build up. Up until this point. And Cotto's older than him, being 35, well, going on 35 as of October, but still yet. I think this is the last hoorah for both of them until Cotto actually takes a big fight. And Gil, I don't think you can sell yourself out here to anybody in the American market any longer. Anything else that you guys like to throw to this before we get away from it? Okay, that helps me a ton. That helps me a ton. Now, interesting. I need to get this preview rolling with the Cavs meeting up with Golden State, but I don't want to jump into that just yet. I kind of want to put a dish in front of my big brother, Brian Hughes, about the situation that is going down in San Francisco. And knowing that he's a chef, I need him to cook. I need him to cook. Now, interesting enough, we've seen player after player either get removed from this organization or what I'm about to go to is retire at a young age. You already had Borland retire. And knowing that he was a very good linebacker and doing what he had to do while the linebacker staff was more or less down and injured, you have their offensive tackle, Anthony Davis, retiring at the age of 25. Young athlete, and knowing that he went through a concussion, is giving up the sport of football this early. And we have people from the 49er organization saying, don't worry about us, we will still win. So this is interesting in itself to hear. Of course, they have to be motivated and positive looking toward the future. But knowing player after player from this roster or organization is either being removed or leaving on their own will, your thoughts on what's happening in the Bay Area, Brian?
Well, obviously, it's disappointing and disheartening. I think when you look at this at first glance, you know, the initial reaction is going to be, you know, everybody's going to say, oh, look, you know, Jim Harbaugh left, so, you know, now all the players are leaving. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but what I will say is what this last year has shown us is that the upper management in San Francisco is just not good. The way they've handled situations, whether it be with a coach, whether it be with players, is just not good. And you mentioned, you know, you mentioned Anthony Davis, but they also traded Andy Lee, who is who set a record last year for the highest net punting average in the history of the game, for a seventh round pick to the Cleveland Browns. And they did that because they drafted a rookie in the fifth round that apparently is going to be the next Ray guy. I don't understand a lot of the decision-making that's going on. I think the larger concern for us as NFL fans is this. If a lot of these young, talented players, I mean, let's be honest, football is here to stay. It's not going anywhere. But a lot of these young, talented players, if they come in for a year or two just to make some money to kind of stockpile 3, 4, 5 years, whatever, just to kind of make some money and then get out of the sport before they, quote-unquote, hurt themselves, you know, end up having any kind of significant brain injuries, things like that, that could be a detriment to their quality of life. I think what this shows us is that the players are concerned about their quality of life after football, that they are educating themselves on the potential risks. I mean, it's unfortunate because basically everything that could go wrong for the Niners this offseason, it really has. I mean, you know, you think about it, you got a guy like Lael Collins that goes undrafted. You know, and this is something we had talked about, Ty, but I said, hey, you know what? Regardless of what the kid wanted, hey, if I don't get drafted in the first three rounds, I'm going to reenter the draft. You know, as a NFL front office person, you should know the rules of the league and know that they're not going to allow him to reenter the draft. There was no reason to allow him to reenter the draft. The collective bargaining agreement that's been bargained, this is not like yesteryear. He's not a junior. This isn't like, well, okay, I didn't get the placement that I wanted, so I'm going to go back to school. He couldn't do that. Once you draft the kid, he's essentially your property. He had no eligibility left. I told you before, I don't know why you don't waste a fifth, sixth, seventh round pick on this kid. And you know what? The Niners would have been a whole lot better off. The problem now is the only other right tackle they currently have on the roster is Eric Pears, who's been playing guard the last 2 years, and a seventh-round rookie who's actually been working with the first team, Trenton Brown, which you probably know a little bit, something about. He's from Florida State. But that's really the issue. You know, a lot of this stuff has come after the draft, after free agency. It's not like you can plan. Justin Smith, you know, they did do their best to plan for his departure, but, you know, anytime you lose, you know, you lose a borderline Hall of Fame player, you know, it's going to impact. But, you know, the really ironic thing, Ty, is if you look at the team last year and you look at the team this year, guys that started six or more games, they've lost 13 players that started six or more games last year. You only have 11 starters per side. So this Niners team that we are going to see, you know, the front office can say, hey, we're going to be fine. We have talent. Look, they still do have a lot of talent, but this is a drastically different team now than what we've seen last year. And for anybody, including Niner fans, to think that this is a playoff-bound team, I just don't see how it is. I mean, right now, if I had to, you know, give my opinion, Ty, as much as I want to be a fanatic, as much as I want to be optimistic, I think it's also important to be realistic And realistically, they're the fourth best team in this division right now. Unless Colin Kaepernick makes some monumental strides, because we know a good quarterback can carry a bad team, this is the fourth best team in this division. I mean, they went 8-8 last year. I don't think they come close to that unless Colin Kaepernick makes huge strides in year number three as a starter.
Okay, and interesting, and I didn't really try to cite this situation on what's going on with San Francisco. Listen to these names and people that are part of the situation that has just happened to San Francisco. With, to me, I'm not even going to beat around the bush. Every name I'm about to announce, significant to me, to this 49er team. Retired within this season, Patrick Willis, Chris Borland, and Justin Smith, and you can now add Anthony Davis. They had four players retire, well, Justin Smith being the oldest, 35, respectable age. I can respect that. But you have Patrick Willis at 30, you have Borland at 24, you have Davis at 25. All, I still think, have at least 2 or 3 years left in them, but just like Brian said, respecting their will to play and the health behind the situation, and know the CTE situation and lawsuit that's going on players that have, you know, left the game and are not themselves physically or mentally leaving the game. Now, outside of the players that have retired, they've also lost Frank Gore, Mike Iapati, the lineman. They also lost Dan Scuda as well. They lost Culver, the corner. They've also lost Parrish Cox, Michael Crabtree, McDonald in his situation. That's ridiculous. And he's continuing on that situation in Chicago. And I think they actually released him in Chicago also. And Jonathan Martin as well, being another guy that had been removed. This is over, you know, 10 to 12 people that have left this organization or have been moved otherwise in the front office, like Brian alluded to. And also, just to add insult to injury, Andy Lee being one of the better punters in the NFL, they get rid of for a seventh-round pick in a draft 2 years from now. So it's very interesting to see what San Francisco's up to. I don't know why they're on an extreme makeover or rebuild, but they had a lot of interesting pieces. Even though some of these guys may have been up in age, I would rather see it look like it's falling apart than for them to hover around a 500 season and then just dismantle the team after they've already been to a handful of conference championship games and being to a Super Bowl as well in the midst of the past three seasons. So I don't know what San Francisco is up to. I know Nacho is probably happiest ever to hear this news about what's going on in San Francisco, but your thoughts with another name added to the San Francisco roster being removed due to retirement in Anthony Davis and all of the players that have left recently as well throughout free agency or just being removed through trade?
Well, happy, no, because when the Packers play a team, I want them to be at their best. So that way, you know, if we win or lose, like I said, we lost to a better team or we beat a good team or a team we beat, whatever. So to see this happen to the Niners, and the one name I didn't hear you mention, Ty, was John Harbaugh. He's gone, or Jim Harbaugh. He's gone, too. So it's... That's the biggest thing to me. With Harbaugh not there, what he did to that team, what he did to Colin Kaepernick as a quarterback, the way he utilized his running skills and his throwing skills at certain parts of the game when it was beneficial to the team against different teams. We saw it against my Green Bay Packers on two separate occasions in two separate playoff games. One, he ran for all kinds of crazy yards. Two, we shut his run game down, so we threw it for all kinds of crazy yards. With Harbaugh at the helm and that team, the way they were clicking for the past few years, with the exception of last year, with all the turmoil going on with the front office and Harbaugh and the team backing Harbaugh and things like that, this is just one of the things I hate to see. I don't understand most of the young retirements, like you said, Justin Smith, I understand that one. He's a pretty older guy. He's been in this league a long time. So I can understand that retirement. The younger guys, 30 and under, I get it. You want to save your health. Maybe that's the trend that's coming on. I haven't heard anyone else recently Maybe that is the trend, though, you know, stacking up some money for a few years and, you know, starting your own business in the degree you got while you're in college and move on from there and have a great life. The parity in the league, if that is the case, if more teams start witnessing this from their younger players, the parity in this league will definitely increase. We will see a lot of teams winning and losing games they should or should not. And it'll be interesting to see how the league turns out over the next 5 to 10 years. If that is the case, if you just come to the league for 3 years, 3 to 4 to 5 years, stack some money, get out while you still can, so to speak, mentally, so you can take care of your family and move on. If that's the case, like I said, the parity in this league is going to be crazy, and we're going to see a lot of teams winning some games that they most likely shouldn't have, and a lot of teams losing games to teams they shouldn't be losing to. So it's going to be interesting to see as it pertains to that aspect. But towards the 49ers, to have so many so fast leave your organization along with the head coach that got you so far, it's hard for me to see them, do well. But, it's going to be hard for them in that division losing so many. like Hughes just said, it's one of those things. They're just going to have to move forward with what they've got and see what they can do. But it doesn't look very good for San Francisco.
Right. And anything like you would like to respond to as of hearing what we alluded to around this situation in San Francisco and knowing that, to be honest, not only an analyst toward the situation, but also being a fan toward San Francisco, trying to be optimistic about the situation, other than Kaepernick having to survive the storm more or less with Vernon and you know, other guys like Anquan Boldin. Your thoughts on that, pulling away from this situation?
Well, the only thing I'll say, Ty, is, injuries are unexpected and so is retirement. You can never plan on either. Any one of our teams or another team could get hit by the injury bug and, be without half their team heading into the later weeks of the season, which is what happened to the Niners last year. What I will say is this, the last 3-4 years, everybody talked about how deep the Niners rosters were, how the Niners had one of the deepest rosters in the NFL. Well, we're going to find out. A lot of these guys that Trent Baalke drafted, that had an ACL injury, or a torn bicep or whatever, that people weren't drafting and he was drafting in rounds 3 or 4, because he thought he was getting a quote-unquote deal. Guys like Brandon Thomas, the offensive tackle slash guard from Clemson, you're going to get to see quite a bit of him. Tank Carradine, the defensive end, he's going to take over for Justin Smith. We're going to get to see a lot of him. So we're going to get to see a lot of these guys that were quote-unquote what made the Niners roster so deep, and we'll see just exactly what we have here. And even though he's a complete pain in the ass and I don't like him as a player, Ty, I think probably what you see is you'll see Boone. They're going to kick Boone out from right guard to right tackle. As you know, at Ohio State, he played tackle. I think that's probably his more natural position because I think it's easier to fill a guard position than a tackle position. So I think that's probably ultimately what happens. And I think the Niners line is going to be okay. It's still going to be in the top half of the league when you look at the pieces that they have. They still have 3-plus talent offensive linemen and 2 guys that are either you're not sure of or average. I think the real question is going to be, how can this defense respond? This defense has always been a top-5 defense. If Navarro Bowman can get back to an All-Pro level, you're really gonna be looking for a guy like Michael Wilhoit, who played sensational last year, but he's gonna have to keep that up game in and game out, to live up to that standard, taking over that Patrick Willis spot. You're gonna have to look and see, are these young guys gonna be able to step up at corner? Because we lost both starters once again. We lost both starters last year. In year, we do the same thing in Culliver and Parrish. So back-to-back years, we've lost both of our starting corners. So it's going to be interesting to see what's happened, to see what happens. But once again, like I said, to me, it all comes down to, you know, everybody's talked about how deep we are. So we're going to see exactly how good of a drafter the Trent Baalke is, because this is every team's nightmare, but this is really what you draft for. In a situation like this, where your back's up against the wall and you need your young guy to come in and perform, we're going to find out what we got.
Okay, the caller number is 917-889-9592. And just to add to that situation, I also forgot that they took the running back from Detroit, having Reggie Bush, and now adding Darnell Dockett, defensive interior lineman, for the defensive side for San Francisco, having to build this up, and Torrey Smith as well. So they still have some interesting names in San Francisco, knowing that, you know, Brian actually stamped, well, not to say stamped, but he stated that they should probably be the fourth best team in the NFC West. I want to see if they can continue to fight and actually keep, you know, a team like St. Louis under them, or actually keep that back and forth fight between them and Seattle. I don't know if they can, or, you know, try and trump what Arizona is doing. It's still an interesting division. You still have to worry about the Niners on a game-by-game basis. I don't want to totally count them out, but a lot of these pieces that are removed from San Francisco does draw for a heavy amount of attention, and at least from my perspective. And I do understand where Nacho came from. You want to play this team at their full strength. You don't want to take advantage of them, because, of course, you'll take the win just for record purposes, but it's still like, you know, it wasn't a challenge. These guys aren't the same way that they looked in years past. And I understand the way that both sides of the fence work. Okay. My next topic, I can't sit on it any longer. I'm trying to fish and throw stuff around here as best as I possibly can. Unless you guys have an interesting dish to throw out there, we can talk about it. But the NBA Finals taking off tonight, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard, Game 2, with the Cleveland Cavaliers visiting the Golden State Warriors to try and even this thing out one game apiece, which is, it could be an uphill battle. And I'm saying could be. I'm not saying it is going to be an uphill battle, because they still have the best player in the league on their team, as noted, LeBron James. And knowing how there has been a good amount of banter going back and forth between media and guys like LeBron or Steph Curry, knowing that they have to be prepared, I want to see how you guys feel about this situation in Game 2. Is it a situation where Cleveland can even this up and more or less overlook all of the, you know, the banter or people actually overlooking Cleveland without Kyrie Irving now being removed from this roster alongside Kevin Love, who also was removed due to injury as well? I want to see how you guys feel about this one moving forward. Nacho, I'll start with you first. Your thoughts on this Game 2 situation? Can this be a situation where Cleveland's going back down 0-2, or do LeBron and company actually put the pressure on Golden State, even this thing up, and force Golden State to win one in Cleveland?
I think the best thing that could happen for Cleveland in this game is that the Warriors come out soft again. They come out a little skittish, breaking some open shots and not taking the correct shots, and then come out the same way they came out in Game 1. That gave Cleveland the opportunity to jump on them, get an early lead, and kind of keep it close. And the fact that they were keeping the lead most of the game, whether it be, you know, 2 points, 1 point, 6 points, it jumped up there a little bit early. But, if the Warriors come out hot, like I think they're going to do, come out ready, they already felt how it felt in Game 1. They're at home. They'll be more relaxed. Klay will not miss as many shots as he missed. He'll come out ready to go. I think this turns out to be a runaway game for the Warriors. They go up 2-0, and they go back to Cleveland. I think tonight's game is going to be interesting in the fact that we're going to see the Warriors come out the same way they came out in game, what was it, game three, against the Rockets, when they came out and beat them by like 35 points. They were just clicking. They were on. I'm not saying that the Cleveland Cavaliers aren't going to put up a fight, or they're going to, you know, fall short or not do anything. I fully expect LeBron James to come out and put up 40-something points. But the thing is, they're going to run the ISO ball game again. The Warriors are going to stick to their game plan, because that's what they do. They find something that works, and it works very well, and they stick to it. That's what got them the number one defense ranked throughout the regular season, and that's how they've been doing it throughout the postseason. They find a defense that works, they stick to it, and then they go out and win games how they're supposed to. I think tonight they come out and they do the same thing. They run that same defense. Let LeBron James run that ISO, back guys down, take 20-footers, take 18-footers. He's going to make what he's going to make. Tonight may not be his night, as it was in game one where that jumper was just falling. We all know about him and his jumper problems. He, you know, some nights it's on, some nights it's off. But maybe he goes to that post game this game, backs him down, and gets easy points. But I definitely see this being the Warriors' game. They're going to do everything in their power. That Oracle is going to be raucous. They already up game one. They're already up a game, and it took them all everything to win. That crowd, I mean, they were all loud, up and going. So they're going to be raucous again for this. Because they want their team to win more than anything in the world. The drought also in the Warriors is very long as well for them to bring home a championship. So they're going to bring one home. So this is definitely going to be the Warriors game tonight. I see this being about a 20-point victory, looking at about 115-95.
Wow. Okay, California rain. Okay, so – Brian, and I want to throw this to you and actually kind of tweak it a little bit. Now, hearing what Nacho just threw out there is what a lot of people are actually saying. Is this going to be a situation where LeBron is going to have to come out there and score 40 to 50 to make this happen, or does he get this team involved and actually rely on his team to help him and do this as a team? And knowing the motto and the slogan that Golden State is using, the strength is in numbers. And knowing that LeBron is going to need more than just himself to get this done, is it fair that it has to be all on LeBron's shoulders, or is he going to have the help of his team get this job done to even the series out, or is there no shot, like everybody else is stating, about this series?
That's great. That's a good question, Ty. I really wish our boy Sirius was here right now. He was preaching real hard last week about how, you know, how we were crazy and we ain't giving LeBron a fair shake and we're being disrespectful and LeBron's gonna will this team to win and this and that. Bottom line, at the end of the day, Ty, if you were gonna recap the game, just like I said, the reason why the Golden State Warriors are gonna win is even though LeBron James is the best player on the court, he simply cannot do enough to win. I mean, be honest. He set a career playoff high in points, and they still lost. I mean, Kyle Irving was probably the best Kyle Irving we've seen in the entire playoffs, and they still lost. Cleveland got out to a double-digit lead in the first quarter, and they still lost. Everything that could possibly go right for Cleveland went right, other than obviously Iman Shumpert making the shot, which I'm going to get to in a second, and Cleveland lost. This is exactly what I said it was, Ty. Go back and listen to the tape last week and tell me if I did not – I feel like I should be called Notre Dame, because this is exactly what I said was going to happen. I said J.R. Smith is a streaky shooter. He went 3-for-13, 9 points. Tristan Thompson, everybody's like, oh, Tristan Thompson, he's the best. Look, he's going to get a big, big payday. He played 48 minutes and got 2 points. I told you who the best defensive team in the league was. Everybody kept saying Cleveland. I said, no, it's Golden State. And you know what? Tristan Thompson had 2 points. Outside of Kyrie Irving, who, by the way, is not going to be able to play because of the knee injury, LeBron James has zero help, and it's only going to get worse now. Kyrie played 44 minutes of that game, Ty. 44 minutes of that game. Who's going to get those minutes now? Is that guy going to give you 23 points? I don't think so. This went from a dire situation to almost an impossible win situation. What LeBron James needs in order to win this game is J.R. Smith to be good J.R. Smith. Like I told you, he is a streaky shooter, but J.R. Smith can get hot. The issue that I have is if Steph Curry is guarding Kyrie Irving and Kyrie Irving is no longer on the floor, who's Steph Curry going to be guarding on the perimeter now? He's going to be guarding J.R. Smith more than likely because, I mean, I could tell you I'm not worried about Joe Harris. I'm not worried about Brandon Hayward. I'm not worried about these guys coming off the bench. I'm worried about the shooters, and there's only a couple shooters. And for whatever reason, they decided that Sean Marion and Mike Miller are not shooters, although both of them have probably more playoff experience than every single player on this team outside of LeBron James. But, you know, that goes right back to the whole David Blatt situation, so I'm not going to jump into that too far. But, you know, Cleveland, you might want to get your guys that have been there before that are accustomed to knocking down big shots a little bit of playing time. But the bottom line, Ty, is Golden State played just about as poorly as you can expect. Steph Curry had more turnovers than normal, and Cleveland still lost. And this is what I was saying last week when, you know, when Sirius was, you know, was flabbergasted, when he was like, oh, you're talking bad about LeBron, the king. No, I'm not talking bad about him. Just like I told you, he cannot do it all on his own. And he did not do it all on his own. Irving, like I said, Kyrie Irving played the best game that I think I've seen him play all postseason, and they still lost. Now, if you want to play the what-if game, what if Iman Shumpert knocks down that jumper at the end of the game? We don't go to overtime. Kyrie Irving doesn't hurt his leg. Maybe we're having a completely different conversation right now. But the reality is this. It was a great game, and Cleveland was in it to the last second. I'm not saying they weren't. But without Kyrie Irving, Dyer's situation just went to completely desperate. And I just can't – I don't think you can expect Klay Thompson or Steph Curry to consistently shoot under 40% from three-point land. Steph Curry's been averaging 44% from three-point land up until this last game. Klay Thompson's been right at 40%. He was under 40%. As a team, they did not shoot extremely well from three-point range. You know, they only made 37% of their shots. So my concern, Ty, is I feel like we may have seen the best Cleveland has to offer, and Golden State did not show their best performance, and Golden State still won. And if I'm Cleveland, I know LeBron is still going to come out kicking, screaming, fighting, whatever. He shot over 50% from the field. Well, almost 50% from the field, excuse me. He did everything he could have done except for knockdown free throws, which I think needs to be mentioned. He shot 60% at the stripe, which could have ended this game, and this would have been a different conversation as well. But the bottom line is, you know, they always talk about in every NBA team you need at least two superstars. You know, if you want to win the finals, you know, look at your team. You know, you got Durant and Westbrook. You know, you look at the Lakers, it was Shaq and Kobe, or Kobe and Gasol. The Cleveland Cavaliers just lost their second superstar. No matter what anybody wants to think, J.R. Smith is a role player. You know, Timothy Mozgov is a role player. Tristan Thompson, these are role players. They're good at what they do, but they're not a let-me-create-my-own-shot guy. They're not a, you know, I'm going to take over the game kind of guy. And I know that Smith does it sometimes, but the problem is he also has nights like he did the other night where he shoots 3-for-10, and then you start thinking to yourself, at 30%, I wonder if maybe we shouldn't give more shots to some of the other guys on the floor. So I think big picture, Ty, I think the game went about like I thought it would. I really wish Irving wouldn't have got injured because I thought the kid played his best game of the playoffs in the biggest stage, so I was impressed. But basically, with Irving going out, I've lost all faith that Cleveland has a real shot in this series. And I'm sure, you know, Sirius is probably just getting out of church, and he's going to call in a second and talk about the disrespect. But I just don't think LeBron can do it all on his own. He just set a playoff high. He has the most points he's ever scored in the playoffs, and they still lost. I mean, how many points does he have to score in order for them to win? He scored 44 points. He almost scored half of their points, and they still lost. So With that in mind, and the fact that the only other person who broke 20 points was Kyrie Irving, a guy who's now out for the series, I just don't see it. You know, maybe Mozgov steps up, maybe Shumpert steps up, maybe Smith steps up, maybe Thompson steps up. That's too many maybes for me. You know, you could also go on the flip side and say, hey, you know what? I don't know if Draymond Green is always only going to give you 12 points and shoot 4 for 13. I don't know if Steph Curry is going to shoot 2 for 6 from three-point land in the entire series. I don't know if Klay Thompson is going to shoot 5 for 14 and 3 from 9 from three-point land. When you have a hot shooting team like the Golden State Warriors, they get a bad shooting night, you got to win those games, Ty. And I think you know that was a game that Cleveland had to win, and them losing to me is just a killer. I don't see this game going more than five. I don't see the series going more than five.
Okay, now interesting enough how this thing is situated, and I agree with you too, Brian. How much does LeBron have to output on the scoring end? But knowing that he had a low amount of rebounds, knowing that he had a low amount of assists, knowing that he needs this team to help him, those numbers have to climb all across the board. It can't just be him scoring the ball. And I know I actually called my own self out saying if LeBron takes 30 shots and wins the game, I have to tip my hat to him. And he did that up against Chicago, hit the game-winning shot and everything. But now this is a totally different situation because his defense also has to play a game, play a situation in his game because the Splash Brothers are actually at their worst right now out of that game with situation. They didn't shoot the ball exceptionally well. They actually faced a double-digit deficit and stormed their way back into the game. And now I think that actually restored their confidence once again. And knowing that there's another chink in the Cavaliers' armor, I don't know if it's going to be a situation where it's J.R. Smith that's going to bring the ball across court. I think they're going to have to go with Dellavedova because he is the natural point guard that can actually shoot the ball and get the ball across court and kind of let J.R. or Shumpert do what they need to do to get across court. But a lot of these other guys are going to have to step up and play big basketball right now. And I don't want to peg it too much towards J.R. Smith, which naturally is going to be a situation to come up and play big, or looking at a situation where Shumpert actually is shooting the ball better than we have seen in his NBA career. I'm being honest. This is the best that I've ever seen Shumpert play since he's gotten into the league coming out of Georgia Tech. So these other guys are going to have to play a significant role. Knowing we've seen more out of Mozgov, I don't want this to be a situation around LeBron. I know he is going to try and shoulder this load, but I don't think it's actually fair. And this is a situation where I actually put the post up there saying, it was a meme. It was a meme, and it said, I scored 44, and they still put the loss on me. And there were still people coming at the situation like, yes, we're still putting the blame on LeBron. So I know that this is something that's probably sticking in his craw, knowing that he has to come out there and do everything right now and be the MVP for Cleveland to at least even this series or get back to Cleveland with some confidence, even if they are down 0-2. Because if they get blown out like Nacho was alluding to, I don't think that they feel like they have a great shot playing in the queue going up against Golden State. I think Golden State can end up taking this. If they win big tonight, I still think there's a legitimate shot for Golden State to sweep these guys. And LeBron could do everything that he wants to do. Because let's be honest, I want to be real honest here. Steve Kerr won 3 championships with Chicago. He won 2 with the San Antonio Spurs. He knows what it takes to close out and win these series. And this is what he's done. And this is his first year at the coaching perspective. And knowing LeBron went off for 44 points, it's kind of like, well, let LeBron feel like he can do it all. Let LeBron do all that he can and stop everybody else. There's no consistency out of everybody else. Of course, you get games where JR can give you 28 or possibly 30. You'll get a game where JR can give you 8 or 9 points. You're going to get games where Shumpert is going to shoot the ball and he'll hit probably 4 or 5 threes. You had a situation where he hit 6 threes. So I don't know what player you're going to see outside of LeBron actually end up stepping up, other than Mozgov, because I feel like Mozgov has a legit shot to actually put some pressure on Bogut. I don't feel confident or comfortable in the remainder of this staff that's alongside of LeBron James. So Coach Blatt is going to have to come up with an interesting scheme to get this job done, but also the supporting cast in Cleveland. You guys can't look at number 23 to shoulder this load. I know that he's the best player in basketball and you're MVP at the end of the day, but you guys have to look within yourself to be professional basketball players to help this guy out there, at least even this series up, or feel like Golden State is beatable while you guys are without Kyrie and Kevin Love as well. That's how I tweak the situation. Anything else that you guys would like to say toward this NBA final going into game two tonight in the Oracle out here in Oakland?
I mean, with Kyrie Irving out, who does Cleveland have to bring the ball up? That means LeBron's going to bring the ball up. That means that every time he's going to have the ball in his hands, it has to be all on him because he's either going to pass it to someone or he's going to take the shot. He's going to be their point guard now. He's going to have to run the offense completely through him. They have no one else that can bring the ball up, so and that can take control of an offense like the way Kyrie could do. Like you said, there's no other person but LeBron on that team that could have controlled, got the ball, and done what he had done like Kyrie could do and the way he was doing it. And even though they still lost, if he would have if he wouldn't have blocked Curry's shot, you know, since we're living on the if game on the other end with Shumpert and LeBron. If he hadn't blocked Curry's shot, they lose by two. He doesn't get injured. I don't know if they still beat him this game tonight anyway. It may be a closer game like game one, but I still think I still pick the Warriors to win tonight in the Oracle. The thing is, Kyrie gives them a better shot to make that a closer game in game one like he would tonight in game two, in my opinion, because you're not going to – like Brian alluded to, you're not going to slow down or stop the Warriors from shooting or keep the Warriors shooting so poorly night in and night out. It's just not going to happen. So they're going to find the ways to get their shots and make them the way they've been doing all postseason and all year long. So, and they're going to run the same defense where LeBron, but the difference is he can't give it to Kyrie to create his own shot. He can't give it to anyone. So he's got to make hope that they break down and do the double team and try and bring someone out so someone can get open and he can get his assist up. But is that still going to be enough? Because you're still missing the assist and the defense from Kyrie Irving that he put on in game one. Because not only did he put it on the offensive end with his 23 points, but he put it on the defensive end with his steals and his rebounds. Kyrie was just all over the place, and he made this game closer than it probably should have been, even though the Warriors were shooting poorly that night.
Okay. We'll see how this does pan out. Hopefully there'll be a different tune or the same song in the kitchen tomorrow at the Monday Night Sport wrap-up. Brian, anything that you'd like to twist before we start to do closeout?
Yeah, two things, Ty. Number one, and I know we got to close up, I'll just say, for me to realistically think that the Cavs have a shot, I think Matthew Dellavedova, he's got to step up big. I mean, he has had 20-point games. You can't lose that production that Kyrie Irving is providing because there's no way that LeBron James can average 45 points every game in the series. It's just unrealistic to think that. Even if he shoots 38 times a game, it's not realistic to think that he's always going to hit 45 to 55% of those shots. So that's key number one in the series. Number two, Cleveland, you got to hit your free throws. Come on, man. You're a professional basketball team. You cannot average 60% from the charity stripe. You're going against the best free throw shooting team in the NBA. This team averages like 92% from the free throw line. Make a damn free throw, okay? Ty, I'm going to leave it on that. As my final like parting shot here, I just want to say this. Tiger Woods, man, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know if you need to go to virtual golf, but at 85, I mean, really, 13 over. I actually watched him chip a putt, Ty, and when the ball got done rolling, it was further away from the hole than it originally started. It's just pitiful.
And that situation around Tiger Woods, I don't even know what's going on. like literally, he's going from on top of the golf world, everybody looking up at his situation and how terrible he's playing. To be honest, I don't know if Tiger will ever win another championship any tournament. Any tournament that he's in, I don't think he'll be competitive. I don't even know if he makes the top 25 anymore or making these cuts. The way that he's playing, he needs to go back and get his old swing coach, his own putting coach, and swallow his pride. I don't know what else he's up to, but it's difficult to watch Tiger go from being on top of golf and knowing a lot of people go to those courses to watch Tiger play to more or less being disgusted on how he's looking. And I'm saying that, and I'm being brutally honest. I'm sorry. It's disgusting to watch Tiger perform like that. I'm sorry. If somebody feels the type of way, come address the dish. I need plugs and closeouts from the both of you as we shut down the brunch here on another Sunday. Interested from top to bottom. We gave you everything that we got. I'll start with you first, Brian. Plug, close out, anything that you'd like to promote as we shut down the brunch here in the Sunday morning.
SportsCityChefs.com. Check out the website. Check out the player interviews, the blogs, all the content that the chef's providing. My man, Rodri, he's got some big things in the work. I want to thank Machiavelli for coming out to the show again today. It's always always fun to have him stop by. Ty, it's always a pleasure, brother. Looking forward to another great week in sports and some great content. I look forward to talking to you next week.
That's for sure. And keep your head up. Everything will be all right out there in Santa Clara. Don't you worry. Don't you worry. All right, Nacho, I need to plug, close out anything that you'd like to promote as we shut down the brunch on a Sunday morning.
You know, Sports City Food Food Fight. You know, we had a lot of fun yesterday. Next Saturday we'll be having it again, getting closer to Adrian Broner and Sean Porter. Going to be a great I think it's going to be a great fight. It's going to be awesome to watch. Boxing's not dead. Free boxing on TV almost every weekend now. Yesterday, though, we saw the travesty that was at StubHub Center with Robert Guerrero and Aaron, I think it's Hernandez. Robert Guerrero gets beat about 7 rounds and dropped, and I think in late, I think it was the 8th or 9th round, dropped horribly and still manages to pull out a split decision. Things like that in the boxing world need to stop. Like I said, we need one governing body in this boxing. We need this 10, 11 different governing bodies with 10, 11 championships, lineals and supers and things like that. We need to stop all this BS and get it down to one championship, you know, and do it right. Get the best of the best to fight each other and prove who the best champions are in the best weight classes and the best divisions. That way we know who we're watching and who we're paying for when we have these big pay-per-view events. And we know we're not going to watch something like we watched last night. Granted, I know if you're playing for that premium channel, you're getting more than just boxing, but some of us just watch it just for the boxing sometimes. And I pay for that premium channel, watch that, and that's not what I pay for. I want to see good boxing matches. I want to see great boxing matches. I want to see what you called the reemergence of fights like Hearns and Hagler. I want to see that. There are fights with that potential. There are fights that have the potential to be some of the greatest fights we could have ever seen. The talent pool we have in the welterweight division, the talent pool we have in the middleweight division, moving on up, the talent pool we have right now is so illustrious, they just don't want to fight each other. So you got to make them fight each other. When they're able to run this sport and do whatever they want, and say whatever they want because they're champions or because, you know, whatever the case may be, that needs to stop. They need to be forced to fight each other to prove who the best is, and we don't have 4 or 5 different champions claiming to be the best that don't want to fight each other. Needs to stop and needs to quit, and we need this to be, like I said, one governing body. That's why I'm looking forward to what PBC and what they've got going on coming up in the next couple years. In their championships and things like that, and their tournaments they'll be holding. So I'm very excited for that. And like I said, it's on national television. It's for free. Check it out every weekend. It's usually every day, every Saturday in the middle of the day. So check it out and watch some good boxing. If not for that, Sports City Chef, thanks for letting me come on. Brian, Ty, you guys have been the best, and thank you guys so much.
And he forgot his plug at Nacho in the Box on Twitter. I'm going to help promote for this guy, man. He's so in love with boxing, he won't even do his close-off sports. So this is terrible, man. I'm telling you, I'll be feeding these dudes, man. They be so hungry that they don't even do their own close-off. So I'm going to help them out. I'm going to help them out, man. SportsCityChefs.com. Check out the website, the interviews, the blogs, the chefs. We'll be back here tomorrow, Monday Night Sport, wrapping this thing up. Hopefully Cleveland can get this thing done and tie this thing up. If not, the heat is on, and I'm not talking about Miami. On that note, tell a friend that it's the chefs again. And if they don't know, now they know.
Ow. Welcome to Sports City. TP Timeless is at the helm.
Feeling kind of Sunday. Ooh.
Moses taking care of the Midwest. I'm TP Timeless holding down the East Coast.
TP, I am ready to rock.
And the only thing, I got one thing to wish you people.
Good morning. It's a small city chance for Sunday the brunch with Mark and TP.
Good morning.
So kick back, relax, enjoy everybody. Don't turn on the TV.
Good morning.
It's a Sunday morning brunch with Mark and Moses and TP Timeless.
Good morning.
So sit back, relax, in 2 hours of facts. And that's a fact, yeah.